Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happened to the 118 men, women, and children who settled at Roanoke Island in 1587? With financing from Sir Walter Raleigh, John White led the voyage to establish the first permanent English colony in the New World. But within weeks after their arrival, the young colonists began to realize they would not survive without fortifications. They sent White home to muster more people and supplies. But by the time he was able to return 3 years later, the original settlement had been not just vacated, but entirely dismantled. And the only clues to suggest the colonists' fate were two carvings, the word Croatoan on a gatepost and just a word fragment. The letters C, R, and O on a nearby tree. Their fate has been a mystery ever since, and speculations as to what actually happened to the settlers at Roanoke has been as fiercely debated by casual students of history as by professionals. James Horn is Vice President of Research and Historical Interpretation and Director of the Rockefeller Library at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. His new book is called A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Jim, welcome to Think.
Well, very nice to be here. Thank you.
We should probably start this by talking a little bit about the England that sent colonists to what is now North Carolina. The country was preoccupied, to say the least, with the Anglo-Spanish War.
Yeah, the Spain really was the superpower of the late 16th century. And for something like 20, 30 years, Europe had really been split in two between Catholics and Protestants. So England represented the major Protestant power, and Spain was the dominant Catholic power. So for around the time of the Roanoke colonies, the 1580s, there was initially a Cold War that developed between Spain and England, and then that pretty quickly escalated into something where there were hostilities on the high seas. So a lot of piracy, privateering, and fighting going on in the Atlantic and Caribbean.
To what extent was all this conflict about control over the New World, which everyone began to recognize would be a huge source of wealth and power?
Well, it was really a calculation that the wealth of the New World could influence the balance of power in the Old World. So the English wanted to try to carve out colonies of their own in North America. The English recognized Spanish possession of Middle and South America, but they didn't recognize Spanish claims to North America. So the Roanoke colonies were the first English attempt to establish a settlement in America.
So, Jim, what did Walter Raleigh know about the place he was sending colonists, specifically Roanoke Island and Chesapeake Bay and that area?
Well, this is one of those mysteries in itself, because he knew, he was very well read, and he'd read histories, Spanish histories, French histories of America and North America. In detail, he didn't know too much about the Mid-Atlantic region, the Outer Banks area of North Carolina. So he had to send initially a reconnaissance mission to explore that area, which he did in 1584. But in general terms, he was aware that there were rumors of great wealth to be found in the Mid-Atlantic region, particularly in the mountains. There were rumors about gold mines, silver mines, and even a passage to the South Sea, that is the Pacific. So these rumors have been circulating for about half a century before he sent his own expedition out there, influenced his decision, I think, to try and locate the settlement in this particular area of the Mid-Atlantic.
We should say, by the way, this is a little bit of a digression, but have we been spelling Walter Raleigh's name wrong all this time?
Well, yes and no. He typically signed his name without the I. So it's R-A-L-E-G-H, not E-I-G-H. But it's more conventional these days to spell it with the I. But being a historian, I preferred the way he spelt it.
Talk about John White. What sort of relationship did he have to Raleigh?
Well, he seems to have been recruited for the Roanoke expeditions in the early 1580s, and he was someone who came from a modest gentry background. He probably was living in London at the time, and Walter Raleigh was living in London too. But the specific reason why Raleigh wanted him on the expedition was to make drawings and paintings of what he saw. So he was, John White was, in effect, Raleigh's eyes in America, because Raleigh never went to Roanoke. He sponsored the expeditions, but he didn't actually participate, go on any of the expeditions in person. So it was really John White who would give him a view, if you like, of the New World.
And a lot of Raleigh's ability to sponsor such expeditions came from his relationship, which I guess we can describe as on again, off again, to Queen Elizabeth.
That's right. And the fate of the Roanoke colonies and of early English America was somewhat tied to this this relationship between Raleigh and Elizabeth. They'd met in 1582, and she had become enamored with him, and he became a very clear favorite. He was already someone of gentry status, but she turned him into an immensely wealthy grandee, as someone who would have the resources to sponsor these very expensive expeditions to America.
Is it fair to conclude she was fonder of him than he of her?
You know, that's an interesting question. I actually think that he was very taken with her. You know, it's hard to know when you get into issues, affairs of the heart, it's hard to know whether they were in love with one another. I think there was certainly an infatuation on her part with him. He was tall and handsome. He was over 6 feet tall, dark, and he was described by contemporaries as a handsome man. He was also extremely intelligent, and I think she was attracted as much by his intelligence as by his looks. And, of course, from his point of view, I think he was attracted by her intelligence. She was also very intelligent, but also by the wealth of possibilities that she opened up for him.
That attraction did not keep him from ultimately impregnating a member of her court.
Well, yeah, he, I think, began to realize by the early 1590s, so something like 9 years after he became involved with Elizabeth, that she had no intentions of marriage with him. And I think he began to worry about his own legacy and family, and therefore he secretly married one of Elizabeth's maids called Elizabeth or Bess Throckmorton, and had a child with her. And Elizabeth was absolutely furious and threw both of them in the Tower of London.
And they were in the Tower of London at the time that John White went back looking for more support for the colony at Roanoke.
Well, they actually were thrown into prison just after. So when John White set off for Roanoke, the last expedition he made to the island in 1590, he did have at least the tacit backing of Raleigh.
So talk for a minute about the kinds of backgrounds that White looked for in gathering potential settlers and deciding who would go on this expedition with him.
Well, one of the things that I've tried to do in the book is explain in a bit more detail who the lost colonists were. We've known a little bit about some of them, particularly John White and his own family, but I actually wanted to learn a bit more about these 118 men, women, and children. There were 92 men, 17 women, and 9 children that went. All the children were boys. Which at first struck me as a bit of a coincidence, and then when I looked more into it, I realized why that was. So in the book, I'm able to set out some more information about the lost colonist background. What was initially important to John White, that he recruit people who he would consider reliable and who he could attract to the expedition, to founding this settlement. And so he went to his own family. He went to Eleanor Dare, his daughter, who was married to a man called Ananias. And he went to several other family members and then worked his way out. So family, kinship, plays an important part in the recruitment of these settlers. They all seem to have been, what we know of them at least, seems to suggest they're of middling status. They're not very poor. They're not very wealthy. And at least some of them, an interesting finding, some of them may have had Puritan tendencies. The Puritans were people at this time, at least, who were trying to reform the Church of England to make it to get rid of what they considered some Catholic remnants. So, if that was the case, if there were some Puritans involved in this expedition, they would be the earliest English Puritans to go to North America.
James Horn is my guest. He's Vice President of Research and Historical Interpretation at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. We're spending the hour talking about his new book, A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. If you've got a question, you can ask it by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington, Senior Producer of Think, joins me now, and we have another important phone number to give you, 1-888-694-6931. You can also make a pledge of support at kera.org. If you are interested in making a gift of $120 or more, you can choose to receive as your thank you a copy of Jim Horn's book, A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. This is one of those books that you will, the one bad thing about it is that you will have to read it in one sitting. This is not a book that you will enjoy for months and months on end. It is fascinating.
It is a fascinating subject, and the book has actually been really well reviewed. If you just Google James Horn, you'll see the reviews. And of course, we try to choose interesting guests and topics for the show, especially during the membership campaign. And we're not selling you a copy of Jim's book for $120. You can go to the bookstore right now today.
$26.
Get it for $26. You can go to your favorite online retailer. We're just trying to make we're trying to ease the pain, if it is painful, of contributing to this radio. Now, this radio station. Now, maybe at 6:15 this morning, it might have been painful.
Painful for you because you were here.
but it's not painful. It's fun to participate in something that is a community forum, and it's a place that you know you can go for very intelligent conversation on a variety of subjects that you want to hear.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to make your contribution or update your contribution. You can also do this online at kera.org. I actually find, Jeff, the older I get, that the better it feels to contribute to something I really believe in. You know, there are a lot of things a lot of us just paid taxes, and I was certainly in that line. And, that's also an important service. Of course, you don't get a choice. But it's great when you believe something is important and decide, you sort of take action. There's something about the conscious action that makes it really more special.
Well, paying your taxes is an act of public service. It is.
I mean, it is.
It's
just
the law.
Not one that we get a choice about.
Well, yeah, it's the law. But, it's not the law that you have to pay for your public radio listening. We just ask that you take responsibility and contribute as an act of public service because, just like the services that the United States of America brings to all of us as citizens of this country, we think that what you get from KERA, you think probably what you get from KERA is worthy as well. So call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and make your contribution.
Remember that if you make a contribution of $120 or more, and you can do this on the sustaining membership plan if you choose, we would love to be able to send you a copy of James Horn's book, A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Our telephone number, once again, 1-888-694-6931, or you can go online to kera.org. Back in a minute with James Horn.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James Horn. He's Vice President of Research and Historical Interpretation at Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. His new book is called A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jim, they left England bound for Chesapeake Bay. How then did they end up instead at Roanoke Island?
Well, they'd intended to call in at Roanoke Island to check on a small garrison that had been left there the previous year. And so that was part of the plan, to call in at Roanoke and then continue on to the Chesapeake Bay. But when they got to Roanoke Island, the mariners who were taking them, transporting them, decided that they wanted to disembark the whole group so that they could take the ships and as soon as possible get back to the Caribbean to plunder Spanish shipping. So, as I mentioned, this is a period of privateering, and there was great riches to be found on the high seas in the form of Spanish ships and treasure ships and so on. And these particular sailors wanted to get back to that. So they really gave the settlers little choice but to set up on Roanoke Island.
Checking in on that garrison proved to be a very discouraging thing.
It did, because the only evidence that they found was the bleached bones of one member of that garrison. And they subsequently learned from Indian peoples that soon after the English had left that garrison there, the garrison was wiped out in an Indian attack. And that really was a clear indication that the local Indian people, called the Secatans, were continuing to be hostile towards the English. They didn't want the English invading their land.
And there were early and severe problems, as sort of has been sadly the history of the colonization of this country, with disease. The instant that Europeans arrived, the Secatans were among those who were largely wiped out.
They were. And as many people know, Indian peoples had little immunity to old world diseases. And it could have been any number of diseases, influenza or smallpox, that wiped out large numbers. The Indians, at least according to the English, saw this as some kind of divine intervention or some kind of supernatural weapon that the English had at their disposal. They even talked about invisible bullets, these pathogens that were spreading through them. But that mortality brought on by the arrival of the Europeans, I think, was a key factor in the deterioration in relations between the two peoples.
They did have decent relationships with Native Americans who were living on Croatoan Island. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. When the English undertook that reconnaissance expedition I mentioned, that was in 1584, so it's 3 years before the Lost Colony. But during that early expedition, they picked up and took back to England two Indians. One was called Mantio and the other was called Juanches. And one of those, Mantio, became quite friendly with the English and almost became anglicized. In fact, eventually did convert to the Church of England and was adopting English ways, English language, and English dress. He was the son of the female chief of the Croatan people on Croatan Island, which was about 50 miles south of Roanoke Island.
So at what point did it start to occur to the colonists that they would have ongoing issues? There was this guy, George Howe, I guess, who went out looking for crabs.
For crabs, yeah. And got more than he bargained for, unfortunately. John White, I think, had been hopeful that he might be able to restore good relations with the Indians. And I think this was part of a broader ambition to convert the local peoples of the Roanoke region and elsewhere in North America to the Protestant faith. So remembering that much of America was Spanish, so therefore much of America was Catholic, what the English had in mind was a Protestant North America. So we have to remember that with these early efforts to set up colonies in North America by the English, this is very ambitious. They're thinking on a broad scale of converting all Indian peoples over to the Church of England and almost making them, as it were, English subjects. So John White had set out with high hopes that he could achieve this by fair and plain honest dealing with the Indians. But within a couple of days of their arrival, as you mentioned, George Howe went out crabbing in a nearby creek and was attacked by a group of Secatan warriors and killed. And when the lost colonists found the body, they immediately realized that things were in a dangerous situation. And that was confirmed when they later managed to talk to some people of Manteo, Croatoans, who confirmed that the local peoples were still very much hostile. So that was a clear indication that all was not well.
Were they initially rattled, and did they think this is a threat to their very existence, or did they think this is something that we can get beyond? And at what point did they start to realize they needed to send John White back for more?
Well, I think there were a number of factors that contributed to that decision. And the first was that on the voyage over to America, they'd stopped off in the West Indies and called in at Puerto Rico. And during that brief visit there, they were refreshing their water casks and trying to get food supplies. Two of their number, who I believe were both Irish and possibly both Catholics, two men deserted. So when when John White and the expedition left Puerto Rico and headed up to the Outer Banks, they knew there was a good possibility that these two deserters on Puerto Rico might tell the Spanish authorities where they were. And if the Spanish found out the location of this settlement, whether it be on Roanoke Island or in the Chesapeake Bay, they would go looking for it. So that was one danger. The second was the Indian threat. And the third was running out of supplies. They'd brought enough supplies with them to last them for maybe 6 months or so after landing, but they were worried that they would run out of supplies if they weren't supplied by friendly Indians. They were rather counting on that. So they then decided, within about 3 weeks, 4 weeks of their arrival, to send John White back to England for reinforcements.
The one bit of joy that he had while he was still there at Roanoke Island was the birth of his granddaughter.
That's correct, yeah. The first English child born in America and named aptly Virginia Dare. And one of the interesting things I found during the course of the research for this book was that Virginia had a brother, John, and a sister, Thomasin, living in England. So when Eleanor Dare, the mother, came over with her husband, she left two of her children, two young children, back in England, presumably with relatives. That's something that I hadn't realized before I did some further research into their backgrounds.
Do you think the thought was essentially that it was just too much to put a small child through?
Well, I think a number of the colonists left their, on the part of the men, left their wives behind, or left, if they were coming over as a couple, they might have left one of the children behind. It sounds rather odd to do that, break up the family, but the idea was that they would establish themselves and then bring the rest of the family members over. And, of course, as it happened, they never had that opportunity.
How was it, Jim, that White was chosen to go back as opposed to another member of the party?
Well, it's curious, isn't it? Because John White was the leader of the expedition. He was formerly the governor of this new settlement that was to be established. I can't think of another example of a governor, of a leader being sent back by the rank and file so quickly. And he was very conscious of this. In fact, he argued with them that he shouldn't go because he would be accused of abandoning the colony and would be discredited in England for leaving his post. But they felt, the colonists felt, that he had the best chance of persuading Raleigh to send reinforcements. So I think they felt he was the only person who could do it and therefore insisted that he went. And remarkably, they gave him a letter, almost a testimonial from themselves, saying that he had gone at their express wish.
So he was able to get back to England fairly expeditiously, but then turning back around once again proved to be just a huge task.
Well, and it's he considered himself later in life a pretty unlucky person. And I think if you have the opportunity to read the book, you'll find that indeed he was pretty unlucky. And what intervened when he was trying to get back in the spring of 1588, rumors of a great invasion force that was being sent by Philip II, the King of Spain, against England. Those rumors were beginning to circulate in England, and therefore the Queen ordered all ships to stay within home waters. She had to think about the security of the realm, not about this colony on the other side of the Atlantic. So a big expedition was just about to leave for Roanoke Island, again sponsored by Raleigh, but they were not permitted to go. And in fact, those ships, the bigger ships at least, the larger ships, were put into the English Navy that defended England against the Spanish Armada.
James Horn is my guest this hour. He's Vice President of Research and Historical Interpretation at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. His new book is called A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. We will talk after this break about exactly what John White found when he did return to Roanoke Island. Some of you know the story, but there are interesting details ahead. Right now, we would ask that you call us and support KERA, support this kind of great discussion on every subject from history to science to politics, to art, to ethics, to culture. Call 1-888-694-6931. Keep public radio strong and healthy in your community.
It's very easy when you call 1-888-694-6931 or contribute online safely and securely at kera.org. You'll be joining the folks that have helped raise $112,000 so far since we started Friday morning. It's apparently a record pace for the drive. And you know what? That's great, because we've been telling you for a couple of years, hey, you know, if you're going to join early in the drive. We'll get it over that much faster, because when we reach the overall goal, the drive ends immediately. So join the fantastic listeners who now support the station, like Alicia Forsyth in Plano, Kane Rodriguez in Dallas. We also heard from, Bill Gerton in McKinney, Connie Sanford in Dallas, Susie Thompson in Dallas, and Miriam Meisenbach in Dallas.
Thank you, Elizabeth Presley in Southlake, Julie Ross in Grapevine, Mr. and Mrs. Lori Jacobs in Dallas, Mandy Burnett in Dallas, and Rupert Manellis in Arlington. The number to call, 1-888-694-6931, or go online to kera.org. We do have copies of James Horn's amazing book, A Kingdom Strange, available at the $120 level. I have loved this story since I was a kid. There is a lot in this, even as a casual follower of the Roanoke colony. There's a lot that has not been written about before, really excitingly told, and getting that sense of people's personalities and their motivations is just a really wonderful thing.
Wasn't there a Leonard Nimoy in Search of?
That's exactly. I totally remember it. I that was what got me interested in the story. I think you and I were probably about seven or eight years old that came out, and yeah, it was great. And this is better.
Yeah, well, it's
all
a fantastic,
due respect to Leonard.
It's a fantastic conversation, and you know, Chris, you packaged what's coming up next a moment ago. Good job on that, by the way.
Thank you very much.
I want to stay tuned. I'm sure you want to stay tuned. Call right now, 1-888-694-6931, or go online to KERA.org. You can secure your very own copy of Jim Horn's book, A Kingdom Strange, if you join the station at the $120 membership level, and know that your contribution is going to continue the conversations right here on Think Middays on KERA, and all of the local and national programming you enjoy on KERA. And we're just saying thanks with a copy of this book because, you know, whatever it takes to get your involvement, we already bring you, and NPR already brings you, the best radio has to offer. We're just trying to figure out a way to get you a little bit more involved.
The thing that makes public radio possible is public support. And you say public support and you think, well, there's government funding. There's really only a tiny fraction, less than 10% of our money comes from the federal government. We don't get any state government support. We do have some foundations and organizations and underwriters that give us some money. But the majority of it comes from listeners, people just like you. And as Ira Glass always says, it's you, the individual, you, not the broad, everybody out there, but you. Your contribution, whether it's $5 or $10 a month or $1,500 a year or more, we know that we have people who are at all levels, but your contribution really does make a difference. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also set all of this up online at KERA.org.
From what I understand, Chris, this year, it's always over 50% of the station's budget that comes directly from listener supporters. This year, it's getting close to 60%. This morning, I was told it's almost 60% of the station's budget comes from contributions. And you know what? You've been there, and thank you so much if you've been there for the station in the past. You know what? We're asking you to be there again because it's membership week. If you made a contribution back in January, or even if you made a contribution in October, if you made a contribution last year at this time, it's time to renew. But even if you're a current member, please consider contributing a little bit. Because your contribution not only helps defray the cost directly, but it also helps influence maybe someone who hasn't contributed. When they hear that we've raised this much money or when they hear someone's name, you know what? Because that's really our ultimate goal is everyone's participation. If you've never contributed, please do your part right now. Please come on and call 888-694-6931.
Thanks to Joshua Deuce in Quinlan and Don Barber in Fort Worth. Thanks to George Dimsdale in Arlington and Sean Cosgrove in Dallas. They have called 1-888-694-6931 or gone online to KERA.org. It takes, about a minute and a half, Jeff?
Yeah, to do the pledge form online, you fill it out yourself. It just takes a minute and a half. If you want to spend a little more time, you can look at some of the thank you gifts that are available online as well. But whatever it takes, it takes your next step to get involved. To make public radio in North Texas a success, it does require your participation. So call us, 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vice President of Research and Historical Interpretation at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, James Horn. His new book is called A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jim, 3 years to the day after the birth of little Virginia Dare, John White is able to return finally with two ships and supplies. What does he find?
Well, this is one of the most poignant moments, I think, in early American history because he, having struggled so hard to get back, he makes it back to the island in August of 1590 and. They're sounding trumpets, they're singing English songs to see if there's any response from the island, any smoke signals. In fact, they do see a smoke signal, but far to the south, so not on Roanoke Island. But they land and explore and then reach the settlement, finally, to find it deserted. And then White must have been terrified to find the remains of the settlers or evidence of fighting. But fortunately, there was no evidence of fighting, and in fact, it looked as though from what he found there that the settlers had withdrawn in an orderly fashion, that they'd left careful planning. And so he found the two signs that you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Crow and Croatoan, indicating where they had gone. So it must have been with many with mixed feelings that he really left the island, disappointed, bitterly disappointed. He hadn't been able to make contact with his daughter and granddaughter and others, but also relieved that apparently at least some of them were safe on Croatoan Island.
And then they were not found on Croatoan Island.
Well, yeah, I mentioned he was unlucky, and so he was, because he persuaded the ship's captain to take him down to Croatoan, and then a hurricane, or at least a severe storm, blew up and drove the ship off the coast. They planned then to return to the island later, but they were driven so far out to sea that the captain decided ultimately to return to England. So he never made it to Croatoan Island, and that was essential because the settlers on Croatoan Island would have told him where all of the settlers were, because not all of the settlers could have joined Manteo's people, the Croatoans, on that island. It was just too small to support the whole group of English colonists. So the larger group must have gone somewhere else.
What do you make of the fragment word? Is it simply that it was a waste of time to carve the entire word Croatoan? It doesn't seem like repeating that would have taken too much time.
Yeah, I really don't know what to make of that, whether they felt it was sufficiently clear what crow would have meant. The most important thing, as White looked at that tree or at the post of the settlement, was that there was no cross over the letters. He'd left instructions with the settlers that if they'd been attacked or in desperate need, they should carve a cross into a tree, but there were none, and so that was another indication that they were still safe.
For a long time, people who looked at this had a sort of standard view that if the colonists went of their own volition, that they probably moved south. Why do you think that they probably went west instead?
Well, the standard view is that they continued. They left the island. The main group left the island and went actually north. To the Chesapeake Bay, and the assumption was that that was their original destination, and so that's where they would have ended up. But it's not plausible that they went to the Chesapeake Bay. It would have been a much more difficult journey getting there, when they left the island, they would have been going by a small ship, and it would have taken at least three or four journeys, I estimate, to get up to the Chesapeake Bay. So very difficult navigation. Whereas going west, which is directly up a large body of water called Albemarle Sound, it would have been a much more direct and easier route. Not only that, but when they went inland, they would have been able to join another group of Indians who were friendly on the big river called the Chuan River, called the Chowanoc people. And they, I think, wanted to seek refuge with this group of Indians inland in the interior.
Did their disappearance have any kind of a chilling effect on further colonization plans?
Yeah, I think it did, because there's no serious attempt to develop English settlements, colonies in North America, for another 20 years until Virginia. And another reason for that was because in terms of profits, in terms of making money, it was probably a better bet to go in for privateering and seeing what you could take on the high seas attacking Spanish ships.
Is there any chance that the Spaniards might in fact have played any kind of role in the colonists' disappearance?
I don't think they played a role other than indirectly, in the sense that the colonists probably One of the factors, one of the reasons they left the island was because they were worried about the Spanish finding them. I've looked at Spanish archives and records, and there's nothing in Spanish records that suggests that the Spanish did find any survivors of the lost colony. Although, of course, they did try to locate where the settlement was, and they sent an expedition both in 1587 and in 1588 to the Outer Banks and also to the Chesapeake Bay looking for them. It's one of the reasons we know for sure that the colonists, the lost colonists, had left Roanoke Island before the summer of 1588, because that was when the Spanish explored the area and didn't find any evidence that they were still there.
How reliable do you think are the accounts that they somehow were absorbed into local native populations?
Well, I think they are pretty reliable, and much of this evidence comes from a later period, from the Jamestown years. So this was the English settlement on the James River, Jamestown of 1607. And there's a whole number of rumors and information that the English pick up from local peoples, suggesting that survivors of the lost colony can still be found in the interior of North Carolina. So there's a different range of evidence, or at least different components of evidence, all pointing in that same direction. So I tend to think that there is a good reason to think that that was the case.
A few years ago, there was an initiative to collect DNA from people who might have been descendants of the colonists. Has that yielded any useful information?
Well, I think a good deal of that work is still going on, and particularly around particular individuals, around people involved in earlier expeditions to Roanoke. There was a colony of 1585-1586, and there's one DNA project that revolves around a person called Chandler, who is a member of that expedition. We're really looking forward to finding out the results of some of these, some of that DNA research that's going on right now.
Why do you think this story has, for you as a historian, really captured your attention in the way that it has?
Well, I just think it's an incredible story. This is a story that involves thinking about the Elizabethan age, the golden years of Elizabeth, the Queen herself, Sir Walter Raleigh, other important courtiers. It involves privateers like Sir Francis Drake, and it involves ordinary men and women who set out to establish the first English colony in America, and I think also quite possibly establish the Church of England and the first Protestant church in North America. I think it's a story that has a great range of drama within it. The personal drama of John White leaving his family behind and never getting back to them. So on a number of levels, I think it's just a great story, and really was a great story to tell in the book.
James Horn is Vice President of Research and Historical Interpretation and Director of the Rockefeller Library at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. His new book is called A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Jim, it really is a fascinating story. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you who have called this hour to support KERA at 1-888-694-6931. You can also go to kera.org. One of our missions here at KERA is to support all of you who really want to have a life of learning. It doesn't stop when you finish school. It doesn't stop when you walk out the door of your public library. It happens all the time. It's wonderful to be able to sort of take learning along with you in your car, in headphones, at home. And KERA allows that to happen. We're able to provide the service because of your financial support.
And you can make your contribution of financial support very easily at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. And think of it this way. When you contribute dollars to the station, you're not supporting us. You're supporting the service that you use. Because, you know, quite frankly, Chris and I are thrilled to be here and able to talk to you and encourage you to join the station. But if it wasn't us, it'd be someone else who would, you know, I mean, you know, the world goes on, right? Would be equally qualified to invite you to join the station and to bring you these conversations. To me, and I started my public radio career really as a listener and really got into listening to public radio and said, you know, I'm going to go get whatever job I can at a station that does what I'm really interested in. And, you know, supporting the station is kind of like that. You know, well, you found something that you really, really like and you'd like to use and listen to. Well, when you make that first gift of support to the station, you're getting in to a sort of a career as a supporter of public radio. And that's really all we're inviting you to do, is to take that next step to become that important part of the puzzle that makes this public radio station possible. Call 888-694-6931. Go online to KERA.org. Please do it right now and make that contribution, because that's what it's all about.
If you're interested in a thank you gift, you can, of course, call 1-888-694-6931 or go to KERA.org. Make a contribution of $120 or more and choose to receive a copy of A Kingdom Strange, The Brief and Tragic History of the Lost Colony of Roanoke. Really is a very interesting book.
It's always been a fascinating story. We were talking earlier about Leonard Nimoy. Mr. Spock, and the In Search Of series. And it's fascinating, and we'd love to send you a copy of the book. Of course, you can go get it today. Contribute $80 to the station or $90 to the station and go get a copy of the book at the bookstore. Just contribute something to the place where you learned about this topic and you heard this interview, because if that's what gets you started on your reading list, if this show or the Diane Rehm show or the interviews you hear on KERA get you started, then figure out what that's worth and go do your part. Call us, 888-694-6931.
This is your source for NPR News, 100.1 K261 CW Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR Wichita Falls, 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman, and of course 90.1 KERA in Dallas.
Fort Worth Denton,
and online at KERA.org.
FCC duties checked
done
off
for
the
hour.
List for the hour. We're just now, you know, really just kind of waiting to hear from you. I mean, we've heard from Dr. Vincent McNeil in Allen. Thank you, Dr. Vincent. We've heard from Casey Keeling in Austin, Texas, Justin Trantum in Mansfield, and Michael Walden in Burleson.
And your call will be very much appreciated when you make it now or when you go online. Those contributions count as well. I think, Jeff, maybe finally everybody believes us when we say the sooner we make all the financial goals, the sooner we'll be finished with this. You know, it takes us all a while to learn these life lessons that if you clean the kitchen as you go along, you have less work after dinner. I think it's sort of the same thing. If you're going to make a contribution anyway, call now. Make it now and be part of this sort of surge of people that allows us to get to the end as soon as possible.
Yeah, the overall goal for the drive, it's $700,000. And, you know, we know it's a lot of money. $100 is a lot of money to me.
To public radio employees.
To anybody.
We value it when you send it.
We realize it. But the fact of the matter is, that's what's necessary to raise to keep the station healthy and to keep it moving forward. And, you know, so far, many of you have called. Many of you have gone online since Friday morning at 7. And together, we've all been able to raise about $112,000, which is remarkable because we're just now halfway through the day on Monday. So we could really make great strides today and tomorrow if you would go ahead and make that gift of support today, especially if you've never supported the station. If you're new to the area or you're new to public radio, $35 is the basic membership level. We'd love to get you involved today because that's what it's all about. It's about supporting the resource that you depend on.
Think about this. When you look at your credit card statements or your online bank statements, not too many of us look at the checkbook on a regular basis anymore because you check this online, but what do your expenditures say about you and about what you value? You know, probably there's a mortgage or a rent payment, and there's food, and there are other things, and then there are the discretionary expenses, which really reveal what you care about. I think it feels great to be able to look at that statement and see public radio's on there.
Apparently, I care quite a bit about the old monk.
Well, that's an issue we'll take up with your wife. 1-888-694-6931.
But, you know, really, if you look at what you spend in a month and where you go and what you do and what you spend your money on, think about how reasonable a subscription to KERA is. If it's a $60 yearly contribution Personally, that's, you know, if you find a really great place that's super cheap, you can maybe go out to dinner with a friend or your spouse or your loved one for $20. So that's, you know, it's like going out a couple of times a year. It's really reasonable, and I think that you'll find it's worth it.
And you probably spend more hours of your week listening to the radio station than even Jeff spends at the Old Monk. Consider that. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Of course, you can also make your contribution online at kera.org. We appreciate your passion for KERA, and we need your financial support. Thank you so much.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.